Okay, it's about 3:37, actually. I know there are other people coming. You have the list in front of you. So let me open up the meeting. We have until 5 o'clock. We could go slightly beyond it. As you know, today's meeting is going to focus on the Gulen movement. As I said on the invitation, which all of you should have in front of you, the movement focuses on education, but its influence, or perhaps more correctly, perceived influence, goes beyond the education sector in Turkey as well as beyond. It's interesting to note that very few people are neutral about the movement. While there's much praise for the movement in Turkey as well as outside, in particular for its work in the educational sector, there's also criticism. All you have to do is look at today's Turkish press. We were talking about this just before the meeting started. And just do a Google search on Fethullah Gulen, the Gulen movement, veya Türkçe, if you want to do it in Turkish. You see lots and lots of references, not least because of the current controversy relating to the discovery of an alleged note relating to its destruction as well as the destruction of the ruling AK Party. So, as I said, nobody's neutral. So I thought it would be a good idea to have somebody speaking for the movement rather than have people talking about the movement, which is what we've done in the past in CSS as well as elsewhere. And I'm looking forward to the presentation of our speaker. Let me introduce him briefly. Dr. Yüksel Aslan Doğan is president of the Institute of Interfaith Dialogue, is board member of the Gulen Institute, and editor of Fountain Magazine, which publishes articles by and about Mr. Gulen. A recent presentation by Dr. Aslan Doğan was titled "The Pedagogical Model of Gulen and Modern Theories of Learning," something that I'm not a specialist on, but maybe there are people in the room who are. He received his BA in Computer Sciences and Mathematics from Boğaziçi in 1989, his MSc in Computer Science from Case University in Ohio in 1995, and his PhD in Computer Sciences from the University of Illinois in 2001. Welcome to CSIS. The floor is yours, and then afterwards, your presentation, hopefully, we can have a wider discussion.
Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by thanking the Center for Strategic and International Studies for this making this presentation possible, for hosting me, and also in particular Dr. Alireza for his invitation and for arranging for this gathering here. And I will hate to disappoint him, but I will not be actually speaking on behalf of the movement. That's my first disclaimer, as a matter of fact. Although I am involved on a voluntary basis with two institutions which are regarded within the sphere of the movement, I'm not here as a representative or a speaker for those institutions. So
can I interrupt you for 1 second? But you will talk about the movement, presumably.
Definitely.
Okay. Just to make sure. Yeah. Otherwise, we can cancel the meeting.
So the views are mine, and they do not represent institutions, and it's impossible to represent the movement at all. And the second disclaimer is I don't come here as an expert, but more like a student of Turkish politics and history and society, a keen, avid learner. So I'll try to share some of the things that I learned in the course of my experience and study. As far as the contents of the presentation is concerned, I'd like to begin with an attempt at a description of the movement, a short historical overview of the development, then some of the values and ideals of the movement participants, fields of activity and some of the institutions that are regarded within the sphere of the movement, participation and fundraising mechanisms, some of the cultural and social dynamics of Turkish society and culture that led to the rapid growth of the movement, and finally, if time allows, some of the views of the movement participants, as well as Mr. Gulen, on some key questions, such as democracy, secularism, state, Turkey's EU membership, women's roles, the Kurdish issue, the Alevi issue, religious minorities and interfaith dialogue, nonviolence, science and arts. But I suspect we may have to leave some of these to the question and answer session. So let me start with an attempt at the description of the movement. This is only an attempt because it is a far-fetched social phenomenon that started out as a community, but now it is well beyond the definition of a community in the sociological sense. It is a civil society movement. The closest term in the social science terminology is civil society movement that is rooted in a particular understanding of Islamic faith that originated in the Turkish society. The first group of people, namely college students, teachers, parents, small business owners, who gathered around the Turkish preacher, scholar, writer Gülen, formed what we can call the seed of this movement in the late 60s in Turkey, in the western city of Izmir. For ease of reference, the Western scholars usually refer to the movement as Gülen movement after the main source of inspiration. The movement participants themselves refer to it as Hizmet, which means in Turkish volunteer service or community service. In a recent encounter or meeting with late Professor Louis Kanturi, Mr. Gülen himself stated his preferred term, that is, the movement of humans united around high human values. So values, volunteerism, are at the center of this movement. The movement originated in the late 60s and early 70s as a faith-based initiative around creating educational opportunities, initially for local communities and then for the nation, and then it went transnational beyond that. Over the 4 decades since then, if we want to pinpoint a start date in the late 60s, now it's over 4 decades, it has grown into a transnational phenomenon with an educational dimension, intercultural, interfaith, media dimension, and financial dimension. The number of participants or people who are directly impacted by the movement are estimated around a few millions. It's very hard to come up with hard numbers because there is no central organization or membership. So we have to go by sales of some publications, such as Mr. Gülen's work on the life of Prophet Muhammad, which sold over 1 million copies, or the circulation numbers of some papers, or the viewership of some TV stations. So all these indicate a number in the few millions in Turkey who are directly impacted by the movement. The students, in addition to the mosque goers in Izmir where Gülen preached, and also the participants and audience members when he spoke at a seminar or at a conference or even at the cafes when he visited cafes, or question and answer sessions which were open to public. In addition to this audience, another group of people who are very important in the origination of the movement are the students and the teachers at the Kestane Pazarı tutoring center and dormitory. So these are students attending a public school but also studying there, and Gülen had a chance to personally get involved with them, teach them, and supervise them. In this stage, we see that the movement consists of circles, motivational, inspirational, or spiritual circles. We call them the tea parties, chai, around chai. And we have meetings about motivating fellow citizens about investing in education, volunteering for community service, helping improve the society in different ways depending on your capacity as an individual. At the next stage, we see business people donating money to build institutions, initially dormitories and then schools, K-12 schools. They are called colleges in Turkey. They are schools, private schools, but they are under the control of the Turkish Department of Education, and their curriculum is secular. They are non-denominational. What differentiates these schools is that there is a principle of embodying or representing the values that are shared by the movement participants, such as integrity, such as deep faith, such as working, doing something for the community. These values are represented or embodied by the teachers and administrators of these schools. At the next stage, we see media institutions, which are seen as a natural expansion of the educational initiative to the masses. Then we see the relief agency, which came into existence after the earthquake of 1999. We see business organizations, associations, which now collectively include tens of thousands of businesses under their umbrella. We also see hospitals, healthcare institutions. In the late 80s, with the fall of the Iron Curtain, we see the movement transforming into a transnational phenomenon, especially filling the gap in educational needs in the Central Asian countries. Due to the close cultural ties with the Turkic populations, the movement volunteers and the business people went to these countries and established schools and other educational institutions. So in the late 80s, the movement became transnational, and then it went beyond these countries now to all of the five continents. So it is possible to find, according to various estimates, over 300 schools in Turkey, K-12 and college prep and a university. And in other countries as well, over 200 such institutions. Today, there is no headquarters or no hierarchy or central organization, but based on the various sources of estimates that I provided, the impact is estimated around a few million, the direct immediate impact. In every city and town of Turkey, it is possible to find some activity, either a school, a private school, or a tutoring center, college prep center, or a relief organization that can be associated with the movement. So the movement grew from a handful of individuals around Gulen in Izmir into millions in a matter of 4 decades, a very fast, rapid growth by any standards. So what were the factors beyond or behind this? When we look at Turkey in the late 60s and 70s, we see a number of social problems. These include political fighting between or among the so-called communists, the so-called fascists, the so-called religious radicals and other factions. And these fights were real. They were really, they were armed struggles, which resulted in the deaths of thousands of youth. Thousands of youth died on street fights. I remember growing up in our home hearing the gunshots and the police and the gendarmeries following people on the streets. That was the backdrop. In addition to that, situation, there is economic problems, poverty. There are tensions and divisions and rivalries among or between the Turkish ethnicity and the Kurdish ethnicity, the Sunni-Alevi fault lines, and the religious lifestyle or the lifestyle of the people who are committed to their faith, more observant Turks, versus people who want to live a more secularist lifestyle, if you will. So there are the fault lines and the tensions. And the political division and the fighting is actually on the streets with guns. And people, of course, are looking for some hope and some positive action. But there is the lack of trust. So I think the representation of the trust was a key element in attracting such support so rapidly for the movement activities in those years. So according to my assessment, what appealed to the first audiences who came into contact with Gulen or the movement in general, were these factors. First of all, Gulen was his message was around becoming a better believer and practicing believer with a deeper faith. And we will see that this is the center or the basis for everything else that was done by the movement. By becoming a deeper believer, having an inquisitive mind and learning and practicing, then this makes it possible for people to volunteer their time because they believe that by serving the community, by serving the nation, they will be serving God. So this notion of serving humans, the creation of God, is serving God, is very strong. It's a very strong dynamic in the movement. You cannot explain many of the activities and the growth without considering this dynamic. Serving humans is serving God and your nation and humanity in general. And serve something greater than yourself. Due to the economic difficulties in those years and due to all of the social problems, the youth, the new generations, and the adults as well, they were inculcated, they had this almost subconscious principle that first, make sure that you get a good job. First, make sure that you can take care of your family. And then, if you can, buy your house. And the theme in the talk, in many conversations in the household is your son, did your son get a job yet? You know, how much is his salary? Is he planning to get married? Will he be able to afford his rent? Or will he be able to buy an apartment? Will he be able to afford the best quality of appliances? This is what the talks are about. So it comes to the picture, Gulen, at that time, and saying that, you should not only secure your own future, but you should do something about the community, about the nation, and then next for the humanity in general. According to Aydın Bulak, who was the late Aydın Bulak, who was the chairman of the Turkish Petroleum Education Foundation and Turkish Education Foundation, a board member there, according to him, Gulen gave a new vision. So this is a translation, a semi-quote, you might say. Gulen gave a new vision to the Turkish youth, who were getting trained in fulfilling their personal interests and objectives. According to Bolak, Gulen's combination of faith, spirituality, and sciences offered the best expression of Turkish understanding of Islamic faith. The combination of faith, spirituality, and sciences. And Gulen pointed out to education as the ultimate solution or path to the solution of the social problems. He identified poverty, rivalries and division, and ignorance as the main problems plaguing the society. And he said that ultimately, through education, we can solve these for the longer term. And how? We already had schools. The government was running schools, the public schools. So what is lacking? So he championed the embodiment of the values that are shared by the movement participants in the teachers and the administration of the schools, such as values such as commitment to a safe learning environment, commitment to seeing the profession of teaching and learning as something beyond a salary-paying job, as something that is building character and building future citizens or family members. So these would be embodied in the schools, private schools that are established by these business owners. And they will not have religious education. It will be a secular school, but the teachers will represent, temsil, represent those values. This was a key message. And in this project, everybody could do something. Everybody could do something. If you're a young person looking for a career, choose education as your profession. When I entered my college, which is one of the best colleges in Turkey, the top fields were medicine, industrial engineering, computer science, electrical engineering, and some others. When I graduated, within a matter of 6-7 years, School of Education became one of the top schools in terms of getting into it by the state administered exam. By the promotion of education as a profession and as an ideal profession, Gulen helped elevate the status of the profession of education. So if you are a young person looking for a career, you can do something. You can become a teacher. If you are a businessman who have some financial means, you can help support, start a school. If you are a parent, you can help build a school or send your child to such a school. Regardless of who you are, you can do something. It is a comprehensive, embracive project that where everybody can do something. Do not expect everything from the government. The Turks hold the government almost at the sacred status. They respect the government a lot. But they also expect a lot from the government. So similar to Kennedy's message to the American people, he said, don't expect everything from the government. Do not try to delegate your responsibility. The responsibility of bringing up your child is ultimately yours. Yes, government is going to help with that, but you cannot delegate to the government. So do something about it. Another message, important message, Gulen was, the people of the country, especially the people of the mainland Turkey, have a right and a responsibility to be in every institution of their country. And to understand this, it may not be meaningful to you initially, but to understand it, we need to understand the attitudes of more observant Turks towards certain professions. These observant Turks who took religion faith seriously and wanted to practice their faith as well as their children to practice, they shunned some professions. For instance, judiciary. If my son or daughter becomes a judge or prosecutor, then all the judicial system, the laws, are modeled after European laws. So there may be some elements that are contrary to Islamic faith. Therefore, let's not do that. If they join the police force or the military, they may not be able to do the 5-time ritual prayer. So let's forget that. So along these lines, they, in a sense, turned away from many important professions and turned into simply business or agriculture or sending their children to Quranic schools or Imam Hatip schools. So Gulen was saying that, no, that is not the proper way or that is not the ideal way for a believer to live in this century, to live in the 20th and the 21st century now. Instead, every person, every segment of the population should be present and represented in every institution. So do not just send your children to Quranic schools. Also send them to law school, send them to the police school, send them to military school. He openly advocated this in the most sermons. This was embraced by the population. Another important message is the successful synthesis and or integration of religion and modernity, rationality and revelation, democracy, science, arts, patriotism, all of this with faith and religion. He offered the best combination. And I am a personal, I experienced this personally in my experience first with the movement. When I first listened to Gulen, he, in a sense, represented the ideal Islam that I was seeking as a college student. In growing up, I grew up in a very secular family. My immediate family was very secular, but my extended family was religious. So I saw people practicing, praying, and I saw them as decent people, good people. When I did do the ritual prayer, I felt a tranquility in my heart. But then I look at some people who are outwardly religious, and they seem to give me a message that if you are a faithful person, then music is no-no. And then democracy, well, I don't know. We don't know about that. Arts, not really sure. So all of the things that I valued, democracy, arts, and science, they were doubtful, or you were supposed to not be really engaged in them. But when I listened to Gulen's audio cassettes, there was the combination. There's nothing wrong or bad in music or arts per se for a faithful person. It depends on the content. Democracy is probably the best form of government from a faithful perspective. In a similar manner, the combination or the integration formula that he presented was very appealing to the young generations of Turkey. And finally, the comprehensive or outreaching perspective, that nobody is left out in the vision of Gulen and the movement, that potentially every Turkish citizen is a participant. Potentially every human is a participant. It is not simply I and you and this small community that we know, that we try to better ourselves and secure some important positions, and then that's it. No. Every citizen in the country is potentially a participant. And you can see this starting in a few individuals, going to millions now, and in 1 or 2 decades from now, God knows how many will be direct participants in the movement. But from the outset, it was clear that the aim was to involve every citizen in some aspect of this set of projects. I think there were two major factors which were also appealing to the people who came in contact. The first one was the participants in the movement were mainstream Turks. So for people who came into contact with a person from the movement or participant in a movement, there was nothing that was objectionable. Most of Turks are ethnically Turkish, that's the case for the movement. Most Turks are Sunni Muslims, that is the case for the participants. Most of them are Sunni Muslim, not all necessarily. Most Turks take religion to some degree of seriousness, they are not religious zealots, and that is the case for the movement. For the newcomers or for the people who are introduced to the movement projects, there was nothing that is not attractive for them. That is not they're dispelling them. Secondly, the emphasis on altruism and not personal interest. The trust that was seen among the movement participants and independence, strictly rejecting any aid from international organizations or foreign governments, completely solely relying on Turkish peoples, Turkish entrepreneurs, financial contributions. This is very important. Abiding by the law, rejecting any suggestion of illegal activity was important. And non-partisanship. Yes, you can favor a particular party, but leave that at the door of the school, if you're talking about a school. If you're talking about a professional organization, never make this organization an ally of a particular political party. Making political process an individual citizen's concern was a very important principle. This is not to say that the movement participants were political pacifists. No, they were involved. Gulen, throughout decades, encouraged everybody to vote and then to contact their representatives, to write to them, to fax to them on a number of occasions. So be active participants in the political process, but do not ally yourselves too tightly with any political party. And for the institutions, definitely no alliance with any particular party. And for those among us, we have some experts of Turkey. They will know what I'm talking about when I talk about alliance with a political party. There are groups in Turkey who are very well known to have alliances with a particular political party, and that was to their detriment in the growth or the lack of growth for those other groups. In terms of values, I will simply provide you a list of some of the topics or titles of some books or articles that Gulen wrote, some of the titles of the sermon series, which lasted sometimes for many weeks and months. I think the titles of these will give you an idea of the values that are cherished by the movement participants. So here is the list. Deep conscious faith, altruism, equity, tolerance, love, hope, modesty, social justice, complementary nature of science, rationality and spirituality, interfaith dialogue, freedom of thought, respect for thinking, ethics and morality, ahlak in Turkish, family and child education, ritual prayer, afterlife, metaphysical world in the light of the Quran. These are now the sermon series. Virtues that elevate humanity, the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, pilgrimage, destiny and free will, fasting, messengers of God, charitable giving, belief in oneness of God, the world of the heart, spirituality, Quran and science, reflections on business and economics, and frugality. So each of these, or not each of them, but some of them have become books later on. They were transcribed and published. They are all available in Turkish, and some are available in English. A particular one will give you a good idea if you want to study. There is the Statute of Our Souls. The Statue of Our Souls. It's available in English. In terms of the fields of activity of the institutions, education has been the primary area of activity throughout these four decades, and it continues to be. Because it caters to everybody. Somebody is either a student or a teacher or a parent or a supporter, financial donor for a school. So everybody is included in educational enterprise. So these are K-12 schools, tutoring centers, reading rooms in East and Southeast Anatolia, for instance. There are reading rooms in villages even that cater to the village folk. And in outside of Turkey, in countries, in volatile regions, such as in Philippines and Macedonia and Bosnia, Southeast Europe, in some African countries, there is a tradition of inculcating a culture of respect for difference. So students coming from different faith backgrounds or ethnic backgrounds learn to respect each other in these schools. Another distinguishing aspect of these schools is their total commitment to a safe learning environment. Every teacher and administrator aims to keep the environment safe for learning from drug abuse or violence. But a total commitment by everybody in the school is not always possible. For these schools, it is always the case. There's a total commitment. And this is sometimes the sole reason why people will send their children to these schools, that they will know that it is safe for their children. And there is one incident that I learned from a friend that happened in Romania that is documented in a book that I co-edited, The Muslim Citizens in the Globalized World. If you search with my name, you will get that book. There is a chapter on education and philosophy of the movement, and there is that incident that happened in Romania that illustrates this total commitment to safe learning environment. Next came the media institutions, a major newspaper with a circulation of over 800,000 now. Magazines, a popular science magazine that has a circulation of over 600,000, national and local city-based TV channels, internet sites, and radios. Then after the 1999 disaster came, the disaster relief agency, Kimse Yok Mu, which means isn't there anyone listening? And this aid organization has helped or is helping now disaster victims around the world, such as the victims of tsunami in Southeast Asia, floods in Bangladesh, earthquakes in Pakistan and Peru, the ethnopolitical violence in Darfur. And this organization did not simply help disaster victims. They also organized sister family associations where they paired an economically disadvantaged family with a more wealthy family. And this is an ongoing project. In the healthcare sector, several hospitals were established independent of each other but like-minded by like-minded doctors and entrepreneurs. There is two in Izmir, two in Istanbul, one in Ankara, one in Erzurum, and there are a few others that I heard about in other countries, one in Iraq, if I'm not mistaken. Then came professional associations. These are either white-collar or blue-collar associations, engineers, factory workers of all professions, and finally business associations. There are local associations, regional associations, and one umbrella organization, TUSCAN. So under the umbrella of TUSCAN, I believe there are over 10,000 individual businesses that are registered. My next topic is participation and fundraising mechanisms. In terms of participation, the newcomers or the people who are introduced to the movement come through through various mechanisms or paths, you might say. One of them is social networking. By getting in touch with somebody as a colleague in their profession, at their job, or as a fellow student at college, people get to know about the movement and the projects. Often this initial meeting is followed by an invitation to a tea party where there is more discussion and more details are shared, and probably the other person is invited to get engaged in some manner. Students at college, students at college prep centers, or while staying with a student at a house, they may get to know about the movement. And people also learn about the movement activities through publications, such as books or audio cassettes, video cassettes, media institutions, such as the TV channels, or they may learn, they may get multimedia through the internet, through the newspaper or radio stations. And finally, by participating or being invited to participate in a social service campaign, such as a disaster relief campaign or a sister family campaign. So the movement participants outreach and invite practically anybody to participate in a campaign like that. If there is a disaster, let's say, in a country that is published in the Turkish TV and papers, the Kimse Yok Mu volunteers may approach anybody, business owners, professionals, and then just invite them to help in some way. And through that help, they also get to know more about the movement activities, and they may end up becoming participants for the longer term. The main mechanism of fundraising is referred to as the himmet. Himmet is a word which means a pledge to support, usually financially, but not necessarily only financially, in terms of your time, your professional skills, your organizational skills. So there are meetings that are organized every year, once every year at least, in the month of Ramadan, which are very similar to the fundraising meetings in the U.S. They are held in Ramadan, in the belief that the pious activities that are held in that month are more valuable. So people, depending on their profession or income level, will be invited to participate in these events, in these meetings, and they will make a yearly pledge that they will probably pay on a monthly basis. So a person who is a blue-collar worker may say, I pledge to donate $500 to this educational foundation, and I will make $50 per month payments. Or a businessman attending a circle of business people may say, I will pledge 10% of my net income. He will not state the percentage, but he will say, I pledge to donate $1 million a year. So I pledge to pay $100,000 every month. So this is the main mechanism of fundraising. And this money is collected either by an educational foundation or the relief agency. Whatever institution within the sphere of the movement happens to be organizing that event, they collect the money from them. There are other mechanisms such as individual drives for student scholarships. In addition to this once a year meeting, there may be additional drives that approach business owners or professionals to help solicit a support pledge for one scholarship, which is about $1,200 per year, or to help a poor family, let's say, with $500. So these individual drives will continue throughout the year, and people through these drives will learn about the activities and will get involved if they would like the support. The principle of giving is very important. There is a general understanding that everybody who is involved with the movement gives something. It is not forced or coerced, but it is kind of expected that you will be giving something. It depends on your income level, your general income level, and then your ability in the context of your family situation. But in general, 10%, 5%, 15% are common percentages that people will donate. So for a rich businessman, this might translate to $1 million, and for a blue-collar worker, it will translate to $500 a year. So in summary, people participate in the movement either by financial contributions or by volunteering their time or professional skills. They may perform some skill, their profession, pro bono. For instance, in last year, we met with a sociologist, with a group of women engineers from the movement, and they planned this little village in Darfur. They were designers and architects. They planned the village for free. A planning process which might cost a few $1,000s at least, probably tens of thousands of dollars, they did it for free. That was their contribution. There was another group of ladies who organized the kermes, like a bake sale that includes handiwork and actually bakes. Bake other elements. So they organized it and sold, and the proceedings went to this project. There are outreach visits. People may participate in outreach visits. If you are a businessman or professional who are already involved in the movement, then they will do regular, periodic outreach visits to fellow, your colleagues, your neighbors, to some other city or town to invite more people to come and join the movement. And finally, hosting guests and hosting meetings in your house, a motivation circle, a tea party at your house where you can invite your new friends who don't know about the movement. And because the movement is so open and outreaching, I expect that this growth rate will continue, and in a few decades, it may actually reach a substantial part of the Turkish population. And finally, before concluding, I'd like to talk about the cultural and social dynamics of the movement. How did it grow so rapidly? And I like to illustrate this with a metaphor that I call the crystallization effect. If you remember the high school days when you did an experiment with oversaturation. So you take a cup of water and then begin heating it, and you pour sugar into it or some other substance. And then as you heat, the capacity to absorb more sugar is increasing, and you can add more sugar. And then you add and you add and you add. And finally, you begin cooling down this water. And then you insert a little piece of sugar crystal into the water. As the water cools down, then you see the crystal, a big crystal forming around that initial seed crystal. So I think Gulen's impact and the movement's impact on Turkish society was this, that the dynamics were already there. The giving culture was already there, but it was forgotten because of economic difficulties. Turkish people gave during the independence war when they fought against the Greeks and the Russians and the French. They gave everything. So they are not foreign to the culture of giving. They volunteer their time, their everything. So all of the dynamics that Gulen promoted, there was nothing new among them. But there was this crystal effect, the trust that people knew when they give, it's not going to be wasted. It's not going to be used for personal financial interest by a person or a group. So that is, I think, a good metaphor to summarize the effect, the impact of the movement on Turkish people. The sohbet, the motivational circles, that is also nothing new. In terms of the organization of the movement, it can be described as a collection of millions of individuals who have multiple voluntary associations with multiple foundations, companies, professional associations, intellectual or cultural organizations. I am, for instance, involved in at least three organizations on a volunteer basis. And if you were to ask movement participants, they could probably list at least two or three institutions, one being a professional organization or a business organization, one being a local circle of just meetings, another an informal organization, but legal, another being maybe the relief organization, they volunteer for the relief organization. If they're a doctor, they serve as a doctor, they also go out for healthcare screening campaigns in remote villages or to another country. So this is a kind of a conglomerate or collection of multiple institutions, foundations, associations. That is the best description for the organizational nature of the movement. And I'd like to finish by some noteworthy stances of Gulen, which also coincide with some of the views of the movement on some key issues. The public condemnation of 9/11. Gulen immediately published an advertisement condemning the attackers of 9/11 after 9/11. And in media interviews, on newspapers, he gave interviews where he called Bin Laden a monster and the people around him a monster. He was very brave in that initiative. He helped write a book that argued from a religious point of view that suicide bombings and terrorism has no place in the prophetic tradition. And last year, I noticed that there are some people from State Department. Last year, we talked with Undersecretary Karen Hughes' office to help translate some of those books into some languages from besides Turkish. Promotion of education, especially for girls, even at the expense of having to leave their headscarf at the door of the university. Gulen became controversial among some radical religious folks in Turkey for promoting education, even if that is at the expense of the headscarf. Promoting or supporting the EU membership of Turkey as a step toward cooperation of civilizations. a commitment to democracy. Gülen said on a number of occasions that there is no return from democracy, and democracy is the best form of governance humanity ever devised. The view that women can play any role in the society, including judges and presidents. These are usually two positions that may be sometimes held reserved by some more conservative Muslims, but for Gülen, a woman can be anything, anybody, any role, can assume any role, even including judges and presidents. Total commitment to nonviolence during the 70s, political faction fighting in the 70s, and in the atmosphere of 80s and 90s. Commitment to interfaith dialogue at the cost of being criticized for being too soft on Christians and Buddhists and Jews, sometimes being called a hidden Christian or hidden cardinal of the Rome, Vatican in Turkey. And there are pictures of Gülen with a big cross on his chest on the internet. You can find them today. At the cost of being criticized by radical circles, commitment to interfaith dialogue. Promoting spiritual depth in faith is called A Modern-Day Rumi by Shefik Can, the late author of a book on Rumi's life, and the promotion of science and faith in harmony. The view on state is that it is a guarantor of individual rights and human rights and organization and order in the society and for justice and equity, and it is totally legitimate, and the people should embrace the government and the state as their own. In terms of the views on secularism, are we good on
that? You can wrap it up in about 5 minutes.
It would be fair to say that the movement participants would be very happy to have a secularism policy like that of the United States, and those who live as opposed to a model like the Jacobin France. Those participants who live in Europe and the United States are happy to be contributing citizens or residents in their respective societies. On the Kurdish issue, Gülen's views can be summarized with 4 or 5 points. Number one, addressing the grievances of the population in Southeast Turkey. Number two, emphasis on common cultural elements among the Kurdish and Turkish other ethnicities. Third, education and economic development. Fourth, giving credit or facilitating the prominence of opinion leaders. And finally, balancing diplomacy with the use of force. On the Alevi issue, Gülen promotes the building of cemevis, the place of worship for the Alevi population, along mosques where there is an Alevi community. And he also promotes the documentation of the oral Alevi tradition to prevent abuses for political reasons. And Gülen's notion of nationalism, which is to a large degree shared by the movement participants, is that it is more like patriotism and it is not racism. It is inclusive, it is positive, it is affinity-based, national pride that includes not necessarily just ethnic Turks, but also other people who share the cultural heritage that is characteristic of the Anatolian Peninsula. There are other topics, but I think I will leave those to your questions. Whatever topics are more dear to your heart, I'll be more than happy to take those questions while not guaranteeing a satisfying answer to them. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Now, notwithstanding your disclaimer about not speaking for the movement, I think you gave a very good expose. But it leads me to the question that has exercised me for some time. Now, I run the Turkey Project at CSIS, and we focus on domestic politics, the economy, international relations involving the Turkey, particularly the U.S.-Turkish relations. And we have not focused on the work of the Gülen movement, except more recently I have become very interested in the political impact of the movement. Now, you talked about how the non-partisan nature of the movement. It's not affiliated to any political party. You talked about the goals being definitely non-political. But nonetheless, when you talk about a newspaper that has a circulation of almost 1 million, almost double that of the next newspaper, when you talk about TV stations, they don't just focus on educational matters. They have a political impact. And as the recent flap caused by the discovery of a document allegedly setting out plans to destroy this movement, as well as the ruling party, clearly what I talked about at the beginning, which is the perceived influence of the movement, has led people to believe that you exercise influence in the political arena, even though you don't run a political party. Now, when this question is raised with you, although you're not a specialist on political matters, what is your answer? The Gulam movement is outside the political track, but nonetheless undoubtedly has influence in the political arena. And when Ekrem Dumanle writes an article in Zaman, that influences the political process. What is your view of this?
I think it can be fairly said that the movement in general can be regarded as involved in politics, as every Turkish citizen will be involved. The matters of policy, government policy, impacts the lives of everybody. So everybody has a responsibility, in a sense, to get involved. So what is the nature of involvement? I think that's the key differentiation point. What is the nature of involvement? A person or a group of people can get involved by committing, by aligning themselves with a particular political party. That is definitely not the case in the case of the movement. The engagement or the involvement is on issues, on values, on attitudes, and issues. So for political parties who are seeking support from movement participants, to the degree that their agenda or their policies agree or they overlap with the general views or ideas of the movement participants, they will get their support. Either individually by voting or in terms of the media institutions or other institutions, in terms of the people who are there. So today it may be a particular political party who seem to be gaining the most support of the movement. Tomorrow it may be a totally different party. And again, for those people who know Turkish politics, they know what I'm talking about. There is a choice that you can ally with a particular political party and they know you as your guys or their guys and you know them as your guys. Whereas in the case of the movement, it is these are the issues that we feel dear about. These are the values that are dear to our hearts. And whatever political party champions them, values such as democratic society and not non-democratic interventions in democracy, values such as non-corruption, not being corrupt, values such as not abusing the political power at the expense of the large segment of the population. There are values such as these. Any party who champions and promotes these values can get and will get the support of the movement.
Now, I'm going to follow up and then I'll open up to others. But I don't think you answered my question. You undoubtedly have political influence beyond the confines of the movement, beyond the mission of the movement, as you described it. And you're getting a reaction because of that. Now, focus my question just on what's happening recently, how do you react to the reaction against your movement, which seems to be in such vehement terms, when you yourself say that you are keeping yourself out of that political process?
Again, in the sense that individually, as a citizen, all participants are involved to some degree in the process without commitment to a particular political view or party. But you know, if we are talking about the latest developments, first of all, I'd like to say that it will be like an oxymoron to talk about the destruction of the movement. It is the Turkish people. It is, you know, possible to the degree that you can destroy Turkish people. We are talking about millions of participants that come from every segment of the society. How is it possible to destroy anything like that unless you actually get rid of the people themselves? So I don't think it's possible, even imaginable, to destroy the movement. But to discredit the movement, to reduce its impact and the growth rate, maybe that might be possible. And that might be due to the perception on the part of some individuals of a political threat or a political alliance that is not their favorite type of alliance. And such individuals existed throughout the four decades. You know, there are columnists who have been writing against the movement for more than 30 years now in their papers. So such individuals in the media, in other institutions will exist, they have existed, and they did devise some mechanisms to discredit the movement, but so far they all failed because the movement is so deeply rooted in the Turkish population.
Okay, with that I open the floor. You put up your hand first. We'll go there second, and then we're gone. You're first. Can you identify yourself, please?
Thank you very much. My name is Albert Nikemkin. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Fethullah Gulen as a person, his background. Does he have training as an imam? And why did he leave Turkey and resettle in Pennsylvania?
Gulen has been serving as a state-licensed preacher, which is a degree actually a little higher than imam. The imam leads the prayer in a particular mosque, but a preacher can preach in a mosque or maybe in other mosques. And he was a traveling preacher, that is, he preaches in a mosque primarily, but he can go to other towns and preach there. So he was working under the Diyanet İşleri, the Directorate of Religious Affairs, as a state-licensed preacher for many years, probably over two decades, maybe about three decades. In his background education, he completed elementary school education, in part in school, actually attending school, and then through later personal studies, and he passed an exam to get the school diploma. He studied under some kind of legalistic scholars as well as spiritual masters in Eastern Anatolia for a number of years in his youth, and then he continued his education through his own efforts. And he passed an exam that is administered by the Directorate of Religious Affairs in Turkey to become an imam and preacher. He is very well-read in Western literature, especially Western philosophical literature. He can cite many important thinkers in many of his sermons, Kant, Sartre, Pascal. You will find them, if you do a search in his literature, you will find them in many places. Very, very conversant in Western literature. He knows a lot about science. On many scientific topics he spoke, he wrote. So that is his educational background. Ali Bulaç, a very famous author, writer in Turkey, called him a two-winged alim, scholar, and intellectual. That is, he is well-trained in religious sciences as well as the positive sciences. Now, his coming to U.S. Has multiple factors. One of them was the health reason. The other one was political. The health reason is that he suffers from cardiovascular disease. He some years ago, he had a stent put into one of his vessels. He suffers from diabetes. And because of these diseases, his doctors recommend him to stay away from tension and from stress. Now, in the 90s in Turkey, there was this phenomenon of what is called a soft coup or postmodern coup in 1997. When there was a lot of tension between the military and the Virtue Party, which secured the highest votes in the general election, and they became the coalition partner, there were many people in Turkey who were not happy with their policies. And that actually included Gulen himself as well.
Welfare Party.
So during that period, there was a lot of tension, a lot of stress, and a lot of, you might say, psychological warfare going on. Among political or non-political entities. As a part of this process, Gulen was charged by a particular prosecutor for organizing a group to overtake the government and to try to turn into an Islamic state. Gulen left Turkey and came to States initially to Mayo Clinic, I believe, for health reasons. But upon learning or upon seeing this development, he decided, upon the recommendation of the doctors, to stay away from the stress, to remain in the States. You know, if interested, we can talk more about that case, but there is some documentation and books on that case, so I can refer to it. He can return. There is no legal obstacle to his return. But again, for the same reason that his return to Turkey may be taken advantage of by some political parties to make an issue and together to rally support for themselves. He fears that his going back to Turkey may be abused. That is the only reason he doesn't want to go now, not to increase his own health stakes.
Let's go to the next question. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you so much. My name is Sonar Kamber. I'm a Fulbright scholar from Turkey. You just said it's not possible to destroy the movement. However, as you also mentioned, Mr. Gulen is in ill health. And my question is, are there concerns within the movement about the future leadership, about the future composition of the movement? And my second question is, compared to other Nurcu movements in Turkey, the membership concept is very loose. in your movement. People sometimes don't think they are really a member of the organization, or they're just perceived so by the others, although they might not be. Yet, when it comes to working together, when it comes to organizing events, for instance, people would work all together with just a phone call. Can you explain this only through the HIZMET concept, or is there something else there? Thank you.
Okay, I'm glad that you asked these questions, actually. I had a first-hand experience in getting the opinions and impressions of people from the movement in a study by a sociologist last year. So we visited with her three, four towns, and a total of 106 individuals interviewed them, sometimes individually, sometimes in a group setting. And one of her questions was actually this first question, that what do you think will happen to the movement after Mr. Gulen passes away? And the answer that was given almost unanimously, was that this is not a movement about an individual. It is not a personality cult, or it is not a person-based movement. What happened to Rumi's impact after he passed away? You know, his teachings and the, if you want to call it a mission, thrived after his passing away. So people expect, or at least the sample that we talked to, expected the movement to continue to thrive after Mr. Gulen's passing away. Secondly, in terms of the association and organizational mechanisms, I talked about some of the mechanisms through which people get in contact with the movement participants. But it doesn't, of course, stop there. So people spend time, they work on projects. So we can talk about a conglomerate of multiple social networks in the country, in townships. For instance, in a small town, it would be very easy to go from one point, one person to a person that you don't know who also shares the same values and ideals with the movement. So there is a social networking phenomenon that involves a high degree of trust due to the factors that I mentioned, that there is no foreign, there is no suspicion of foreign intervention or foreign aid. There is no suspicion of pursuing your personal interest. So this gives a lot of power to this trust, the level of trust that is present among the participants. Because participation is totally open to everybody, anybody can simply say, go to an institution that is known as a movement institution, say, hi, I share some of the values here, I'd like to be part of this in some degree. And then the next day you can begin working on a project.
Any more questions? Go ahead.
You don't have a microphone, so you can identify yourself.
Sure. It's Elçin Porazar from Cumhuriyet Newspaper. Alpe, you said that you're receiving fundraising money, like 5, 10, 15% are common ratios, ordinary ratios. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know if you can give us a specific total amount for the financial wealth of the Gulen movement, and who manages that?
Well, this is an interesting question. It is, in a sense, an ill-posed question because we cannot really talk about the financial wealth of the movement. We are talking about millions of people, hundreds and thousands of institutions. What is the collective total financial wealth here? You can only go from institution to institution, ask them, and get numbers and sum them up. Besides that, you cannot come up with a single number. There are estimates, the estimates based on how many schools are there, how much does it cost to run a school, build a school, how much does it cost to run a media institution or a relief agency. Some of these numbers are available publicly. For instance, the relief agency publishes their donations and their project costs. Some of the foundations, education foundations, they publish or they make it available for free. So you can come up with estimates, but that's the best you can do. And when you do that and when you come up with a single number, I don't think that number makes any sense. It is a meaningless number because we were talking about millions of people, thousands of institutions. Why do you put them into a single number in the first place?
And you did also say that you don't have a centralized organization, so therefore
it's impossible,
impossible to answer this question.
To again give you an idea, in this past year's study with this sociologist, with some institutions, we were able to get their documentation of what kind of donations that they receive, what does it amount to. It is possible to do a scientific study and to come up with a really accurate number, at least for some institutions. But overall, it's an impossible task.
What is your estimate, though?
I don't have an estimate, and I don't see it as a valuable piece of information.
You know how this leaves you vulnerable to those who will exaggerate your wealth along with your influence. So when you're unable to answer this question for reasons which are understandable, then that leaves you open to the charges that I mentioned at the very beginning.
Exactly. And you're very right. I agree with you. And the only way to actually resolve that situation or help this person or entity get rid of those suspicions or fears or concerns is to actually get them involved in how these projects are managed or how these projects start. You know, the projects usually start with a need. There's not a, you know, a bank account or 100 bank accounts and, you know, money is collected there and then there's a project, let's spend the money there. There's no such phenomenon. There is a need, there is a project that needs to be done, and then people go out and fundraise. It always happens as a fundraising campaign. Hundreds and thousands of such campaigns goes on at any time. As we speak now, probably there are, you know, tens of fundraising campaigns going on in Turkey, in every city.
You had your hand up right at the end, please, and then I'll come back to Monday.
Hi, thanks so much for coming. I'm Cynthia Butler. I'm an attorney in town, and I also work with a conflict resolution organization. A lot of what you've described is very either analogous to or cooperative with or at least consistent with a lot of the standard sort of Christian virtues of education and, you know, reconciliation and promoting these humanitarian altruistic sorts of values. And I was wondering, does the Christian community in Turkey or elsewhere team up with you or support you openly or finance you or do any sort of reconciliation efforts in conjunction with the Gulen movement?
I know a few pieces of information that might help you know, understand what's going on, but I think it's that will also deserve a specific study. The first kind of official or formal contacts with the Christian communities in Turkey happened when Gulen started this interfaith dialogue initiative in the 90s. He met with the religious leaders of religious minorities in Turkey, the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian Orthodox, the Jewish community, the Assyrian Orthodox, and they attended events together and co-organized events together. And looking from the U.S. to this, it's not a big deal. You know, handshake and then be present at an event together, you know, what's the big deal? But it was a big deal in Turkey. And that was a big deal because Turkey just came out of this war that they fought with Greeks, Orthodox Christians, Russians, Orthodox Christians, the French, again Christians. You name all the people that Turks fought, they're all Christians. So there was this doubt among the Turkish population that what is the commitment or the allegiance of the Christian citizens here? Is it to their faith or foreign powers, or is it to their country? So this suspicion lingered for decades into the 90s. So Gulen's initiative was saying, let's, folks, Turkey is now a strong country. Let's close that page, open a new page. Now we're talking about global clash of civilizations. We're talking about making the country more prestigious. Let's work together. We are all in the same boat. Let's work together around this. Let's walk around the message of peace together. So that those meetings were very symbolically significant. That was an initiative. I think that paved the way to more warmer relations. In terms of the Christian citizens being part of the movement or supporting the movement, I know that in the cities where there is such a population, such as in Istanbul, such as in Southeast, where there are Assyrian Christians, some of them do send their children to movement schools, and they do support financially. I know for sure that such citizens exist. I don't know their number. And I know that some members of the Jewish community also supported the movement projects, namely Uzeyir Gari and Isaac Alaton. Isaac Alaton recently gave actually an interview to Zaman newspaper describing why he believed that this is a positive movement and why he is supportive of the movement. So there is some relationship, some support, some involvement in non-Muslim communities in Turkey, but the degree, I cannot talk about that. I cannot say anything.
Go ahead, please. Can you identify yourself?
Of course. Mandana Afshar from National Endowment for Democracy. Thank you. I was curious if it has ever occurred in the past that a part of the movement wanted to start an institution or stay for a policy or a direction that the bigger movement would not be supported of and that the bigger movement tried to stop? Or what would happen in such a case? Usually when you have leaderless organizations, it can start its own dynamic and mm-hmm. can go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. Are there concerns? Has it happened in the past?
I haven't heard of any groups of people who wanted to do something like that that would not be approved of by the larger movement. I did hear about some individuals running for political positions. There's nothing wrong per se for any citizen to run for a political position. But if a person is kind of identified with the movement, if they are the head of an institution that is identified with the movement, for instance, there is a danger there. So I heard that there were some individuals who wanted to run for political positions, and they were highly discouraged. In a couple of cases, it was made public that this individual is acting on his own behalf and not on the part of the movement institutions.
Other questions, please. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Ahu Özgür from CNN Türk Emniyet. Dr. Aslan Doğan, thank you for coming. I have a couple of two issues, actually, if you can clarify. Recently, there has been some concern about the movement sort of not leaving space for other NGOs to work in the same area. There is this concept of you not wanting any competition, especially on the education field and on the relief organization field. Unfortunately, some of the publications have been known to discredit some very good NGO workers. Could you clarify your position? There's this concept of Gulen or not Gulen, you're with us or you're not with us. You're not with the movement.
Did you have a second question as well? Do you
want to ask? I do, but
can I answer that first? Okay, in terms of there being not room for competition, that is definitely not the case. The social problems of the country are endless. They will not be resolved anytime. Talk about drug abuse, talk about children on the streets, talk about human trafficking, talk about terrorism and its repercussions. You can list a number of social problems that need attention, and God knows there is room for everybody to do something about it. So I don't think any participant, any relief or other agency has that thought that either we do it or nobody else does it. I don't think that's the case. That's not accurate. That's not based on any real data. But in terms of media institutions discrediting others, I think that should be investigated on a case-by-case basis. I will speculate that on a case-by-case basis, it might be that this media institution or this individual or this other institution might have suspicions about the true goals or agenda of that particular institution. That's why maybe they discredited or publicized something negative about that. So I think we can only understand that on a case-by-case basis and not as a general attitude of not leaving space. That is totally inaccurate.
Before you go to your second question, did you have one particular institution in mind or one particular case in mind? And you want to talk about it?
I don't know if you would want to comment specifically about the Çağdaş Yaşamı Destekleme Derneği and Çağdaş Eğitim Vakfı, Contemporary Education Foundation, which is
I think
its founder.
That could be an example where some individuals in the movement or representatives or administrators from institutions, media or otherwise institutions, had their doubts about the real motivation of some of the people behind those organizations. I think that's the case, that they had their doubts and their suspicion of their real agenda.
You mean Gulen's publications may have doubts about these organizations?
Yes. I think this is objective. It's very easy to assess this by looking at the publications.
And your second question, please, quickly.
The second one is about this big discourse about Gulen movement students being favored by the AKP for certain appointments, favoritism in terms of Ministry of Education, Ministry of Security, Police Force, Judiciary. Could you respond to that? Why is your movement to be sort of the backyard of a political movement, and appointments go straight to that police, despite, there are secular people who share the same values with you?
If you look at the relationship of the political parties, and especially political parties within either a political Islamist background or conservative leanings, when we look at the relationship of the movement participants or institutions with these parties, it is very complex. In individual cases, you can see political parties discriminating against the movement participants in hiring practices. In individual cases, I think you can also find cases where they are favored. I don't think there is any pattern to it. I know for sure, for instance, in the late 90s, movement participants were specifically either eliminated or discriminated against by a party who claimed to be representing Muslims in the country. I am sure of that episode. But it is possible that AKP or any other party who is in political power, they might be following such practice, but there is no pattern to it. It would be an individual basis. It would be a localized incident. And, you know, again, for those among you who know Turkish politics, there is nothing new. I don't think anybody can accuse anybody else in Turkey for favoring a particular group when they are in political power. No political leader has any right to charge or to criticize any other political party for doing that. Just ask any Turkish expert here.
Yeah, we got about 10 minutes to go. Anybody else with questions on their minds? No, let me see if there's anybody else. Go ahead, and please identify yourself.
Kasım Cindemir with Hürriyet Daily. Why is there this? Why aren't you on good terms with the military in Turkey? Why don't they like you? Do you know the reason?
Very concise, short, important question.
Especially after the most recent events.
Well, to satisfactorily answer this question, I think, first of all, I don't think that I share the premise that to say that military doesn't like the movement is not an accurate statement. You might talk about individuals within the military who might have negative views of the movement, and there might be some in the military who have positive views. And some of the retired officers, generals, have come out and expressed positive views of the movement after their retirement. They didn't do it when they were in office for various reasons. And to understand those reasons, you have to go all the way back to the late Ottoman Empire, early Turkish Republic. And in terms of the movements, look at the military. I think a very good practical reference is the statement that Mr. Gulen made recently about this late incident. He said that on the virtue of this particular document that surfaced, it is wrong to discredit the military because military is a very important key institution in the society, in the country. And the respect for the military is something that every Turkish citizen should maintain and should try to preserve. And the society and the military itself should do their duty to pursue any individuals who do any action, who commit any action, to the contrary. So if there are people who committed actions that are unlawful against the movement or against a political party, that ends up discrediting the military, then I think it's he said that it is a duty to for people to identify them and to let the legal course take go ahead and to preserve the respect for the military at the end. So Gulen has been criticized in the past, actually, for taking a pro-state and pro-military stance on a number of sayings in books and sermons, because he sees the state and the military as the people's state and the people's military. As an institution, he is for those institutions, but he is against the abuses of individuals who end up discrediting the state or the military.
Good afternoon. My name is Radwan Masmoudi with the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I have three very simple questions, but out of curiosity. Very short, but because I'm not Turkish myself, I'm just curious. The first one is, what is the status of the Gulen movement? Is it a legal organization in Turkey? Does it have a legal status? The second one is, does it have any connection with the Nursi movement? Are there any connections or links with the Nursi movement? And the third one, you mentioned that you prevent your members from running for office. I mean, is there anything wrong with members of your movement running for political office?
Thank you.
Thank you.
In terms of legal status, again, this is a social phenomenon, so it's inappropriate to talk about the legal status of the movement. We can talk about the legal status of institutions, a foundation, a company, an association. So all of those institutions, the hundreds and thousands, they are all legal, and they have never been illegal. Throughout the existence of these institutions, they have always been legal, and that is a key principle to always reject any illegal activity. The second question? Gulen has a number of, if you might say, sources of inspiration. You might say teachers. And as a matter of fact, he lists these individuals who are most important in his upbringing, in his formation of his intellectual worldview. And Gulen lists people like Rumi, people like Sayyid Nursi Ghazali. So he lists Nursi among them as an important person who helped form his own understanding of Islam and worldview, but he does not limit to him. So he's one of them, he's not the only one. And the third question? Running for office. So maybe I can clarify what I said. It is discouraged for a person who is identified with the movement as an administrator in an institution or as a leader in any sense, as a social leader in any sense, who is identified too tightly with the movement, that when you talk about this person, everybody knows that, yes, he is a long-time participant and committed person to the movement. For such individuals, it is discouraged that they run for political office, because that will give the impression that the movement now allies itself with this political party. But for ordinary citizens, ordinary participants, of course, there is no such thing, and they do. They do run for office.
Let me follow that up. What if people get elected to political office and then begin to draw closer to your movement? Do you push them away?
The general principle is to remain at the same distance to all political parties. Sometimes people say the same distance or the same closeness to political parties. So as long as this principle is preserved, the political officers or people who hold political positions, if they cherish the values that are shared by the movement, if they promote them, they will obviously be seen as close to movement's general worldview.
You know, for those of us who are trying to understand it, and your presentation today was very useful, at least from my point of view, in trying to understand. One of the problems is that you don't have membership, per se. So you talk about closeness. So, you know, one doesn't know who is in and who is outside the movement. Is that deliberate?
That's exactly the point. Because potentially everybody is in. Potentially every Turkish citizen is in there. I mentioned it started with a handful of people. Now it's in the millions. And if it goes like this, you can imagine that in a few decades, everybody in Turkey will have something to do with it. This is, from the start, has been Gülen's perspective, that we share something with anybody. If you're a Muslim believer, then we share a lot. If you're a Christian believer, we share some. If you're an atheist, we still share some with you. So this perspective leaves nobody out. And it doesn't even leave out the non-Turkish citizens of other countries, because there are values that we share with them. That explains the popularity of the movement schools in very remote places where there's no Turkish, no Muslim person. But the schools are still cherished there. In Thailand, I don't know if there's a school there, but probably the school, if there's one there, that would be cherished by the local community because of the values. The values is the king, if you will.
We're coming to the end, and I think I'm going to push the chairman's prerogative to its limit and ask you the final question myself. Look, you've grown in a very impressive manner, and you described how big you've grown. And my question is, what is the ultimate goal? And the reason I'm asking that is because all human activity has a goal in one form or another, and so do communities and societies and nations. Now, this movement was born in Turkey. Fethullah Gulen is a Turkish citizen. He cares about Turkey, and he's trying to improve the educational system, and he's done a great deal within the country. But ultimately, the fate of that country is determined by those who run for office and who form the government and who determine its future, as I said. Now, is there an end goal? If there isn't, will you just continue growing like this and let others say what influence you have in the political process without you ever defining one influence that you precisely want to make things happen in a direction that you would want to go to?
To answer that, I'll begin with something that I learned in my 18 years of staying in the United States. I learned, in a painting, underneath a painting it was written, success is not a destination, it's a journey. I think this explains the mentality of many of the participants. At the individual level and at the social level, we can talk about goals. At the individual level, for most of the participants, I can say it is to seek God's pleasure through activity, through personal worship and devotion, yes, but also through social activity of serving fellow humans, citizens, community around you, or the nation. To seek God's pleasure through social activity in addition to personal devotion. This is at the individual level. At the institutional level, they have their own specific goals that are actually public. I think at the social level, if we're going to talk about a goal, we can talk about an open society, a democratic society, where no segment of the population is discriminated against or prevented from taking their part in their society.
But no political goals.
Well, to the degree that this is political, you can call it a political goal. And I also would like to say that I disagree with your premise there that ultimately it is the politicians that run the country. I don't think so. Ultimately, it's the people who determine the general course of the country.
No. People who then run the country on their behalf. That's the political person. No, I can't let that go without actually challenging on this. Because, you see, what happened is that the national vision, for example, Milli Görüş, developed in a certain way. They set up political parties. Four of them were closed. The current party has its roots in the Islamist movement. They say they're not Islamist, but they share certain of the goals, like open society, and redefinition of secularism in a manner that allows more openness with you, except they have run for political office. They now form the government. You've chosen not to run for office, but there is a degree of congruence, which we see, not least because the enemies of AK are also the enemies of the Gulen movement. So, you know, it's that line between what you're doing and the political process that interests me just as much at the end of this presentation as it did at the beginning. Do you want to say a final word on this before we close?
Well, I think to understand this attitude toward politics, we need to consider the overarching principle of reaching to everybody. A particular political commitment, by definition, excludes some people. But the goal of the movement participants is to reach out to everybody. How can you do that? You cannot do that once you engaged either with a political party or a strict political view. So that will never happen. I can confidently say that will never happen. At the movement, the participants, the institutions will have an impact on Turkish politics. There's no question about that. It is there now. It has been there for the past decades at a lower degree. It will probably be higher as there are more people who participate in the projects. But it will never take the form of taking over a government or forming a party and finally determining the course of the country. It will never come to that stage or come to that nature.
Well, with that, we come to the end of our session. I'd like to thank you for a very, very impressive presentation. And although all the questions that were raised, including by me, were not answered, I think this is a very useful exercise. And thank you for coming.